today on Against the Grain.
The thing about Trump is he doesn't have that many policy interests. You know, he cares a lot about political retribution. He cares a lot about immigration. He cares a lot about tariffs. And what the authors of Project 2025 recognized, I think, was that they could fill in all the other gaps. They could kind of set an agenda for all those things that he doesn't care about. And, you know, they're not batting 1,000, but they have had remarkable success on many of them.
Trump is well over a year into his second term. Journalist David Graham reflects on Project 2025, the blueprint that the Heritage Foundation drafted for it, and if its goals have been achieved so far. On the environment and the economy, attacking trans rights and diversity policies, and projecting military might abroad. He also discusses what may come next. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The authors of Project 2025 drew up a right-wing Christian vision for remaking America. But it's also a plan for implementing that vision, first and foremost by slashing the administrative state and staffing its bureaucracy with right-wing loyalists. David Graham, who's a staff writer for The Atlantic, wrote about the Heritage Foundation's blueprint in The Project, how Project 2025 is reshaping America. He joins me today to look at the degree to which that endeavor has succeeded. David, I'd like to start with the genesis of Project 2025. What made it different from other policy blueprints drawn up by the Heritage Foundation, such as the one they drew up for Ronald Reagan's presidency? Or would you see the genesis of this one as distinctive?
A little bit of both. You know, it's true that the Heritage Foundation has put out these plans, usually called Mandate for Leadership, basically every 4 years since 1980. And so in that sense, it comes into a lineage. But I think this one is distinctive in a few ways. You know, when Heritage first put out that report in 1980, it was their kind of big splash on the scene. And it was an important moment for the kind of Christian right and for this social conservatism. What we're seeing now is, you know, in the aftermath of the first Trump presidency, the Heritage Foundation felt like it was a little bit on the outside. And it wanted to kind of get back into the discourse that had friction with Trump. They hadn't always agreed with people inside the administration. I think they also were concerned that the first Trump administration had not lived up to the potential. There were a bunch of people involved in that administration who came out of it feeling kind of shell-shocked, like they should have gotten more done and they had failed. They wanted to figure out why, and they wanted to avoid that the next time. And so this was their attempt to both get ahead of that, to make sure that if Trump made it back to power, they would be able to do more of the things they wanted, and also to kind of consolidate that agenda before anybody else could and set a course for the MAGA movement going into the 2024 election.
Well, what would you say are the intellectual origins of Project 2025, since the right is not one single monolithic entity with, you know, no divisions amongst it? In fact, there are certainly divisions. So what tendencies of the right prevailed here?
I think the fundamental thing that motivates most of Project 2025 is this sense of wanting to create a sort of Christian nationalist society. They want a conservative, religious Christian America with traditional families, what they see as traditional values. I hesitate to use the phrase Christian nationalism because I think it means a lot of things to a lot of people. But in this case, some of the authors of Project 2025 have used that phrase to describe themselves. And everything they do practically here, I think, is geared around creating that society. Now, inside of that, you have then some sort of divisions and different camps. For example, there are people who are interested in changes to the way the workplace works. This kind of, you know, the school Holly, J.D. Vance, interest in the working class and how to advance, you know, they say to advance workers' agendas. You have sort of classic fiscal conservatives. You have kind of protectionist Trump conservatives. You have isolationists. So all these people are kind of jostling together. And the one thing that pulls them together, I think, is this very Christian conservative worldview.
Is that at all surprising from the Heritage Foundation?
I think what's interesting here is not so much the views, but the way they go about them. Right. I mean, a lot of the things we're seeing here are ideas that have circulated on the right for decades now. I think the first Trump administration really fired the imagination of many of the people involved and made them believe that things they had dreamt of but but couldn't achieve might actually be possible. And they decided the way to do that was to throw out something that they had previously believed, which was generally the idea that a strong executive is dangerous and that small government is better. And they embraced a much larger conception of government. I mean, this is a really, I'd say, even overweening power. They want to consolidate so much in the hands of the president. They want to push aside Congress. They want to give control of the regulatory agencies solely to the president. And so it's that idea of consolidated power that I think makes this difference. Not so much the policies themselves, which do fit into a long history at Heritage and places like it.
And I'll ask you more about that orientation, but I wanted to ask you about two figures who you write were really central for conceiving Project 2025. That is Paul Dans and Russell Vogt. Some may recognize Vogt's name, as he's the current director of the Office of Management and Budget since the start of Trump's second term. But I wonder if you could tell us who these men are and where they come from politically.
Yeah, so I'll start with Dans, since he's a little bit less well-known. He is a curious figure. He's not especially religiously motivated, it seems. He talks about growing up in a family that was kind of Kennedy Democrats. And his parents, in fact, worked for the federal government. He grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. He got involved in the Federalist Society when he was in law school. And he talks about how, at the time, it felt like a really difficult moment for conservatives like him. The Clinton administration was in power. And so he avoided going into politics, and he went into practicing law. But he remained sort of engaged and interested in politics and was a big fan of Donald Trump when Trump was talking about running for office before the 2012 election. And in fact, he said that the reason is he was really drawn to Trump's birtherism, the suggestion that Barack Obama was somehow not an American citizen. So in 2016, he was very excited when Trump ran again. He was going to waltz into a great position in the Justice Department. And instead, what he found was really hard to get into the Trump administration. He blamed that on rhinos, Republicans in name only, or on Bush people, all these folks that he thought were not loyal to the president and were blocking his path. He finally made it into the White House in the last year of Trump's time. And he came out of it with a real anger at bureaucrats, at civil servants, and also at political appointees who he thought were not sufficiently on the team. And so after the Trump administration, when Kevin Roberts, the head of the Heritage Foundation, asked him to convene a project that would put together this document and put together a push to prepare for another conservative presidency, he was very excited about that. If Paul Dans is kind of an outsider, Russell Vogt is, I'd say, the consummate insider. He had worked on Capitol Hill and also in think tanks for a bunch of, you know, prominent fiscal conservatives, people like Phil Gramm or Jeb Hensarling, who was a powerful budget chief for House Republicans. Also from a very Christian worldview. He attended Wheaton College, Billy Graham's alma mater, and he has brought this very religious view into everything he's done throughout his career. And he ended up in the first Trump administration, eventually being the head of the Office of Management and Budget at the end of Trump's term.
I wanted to ask you, how long-ranging do you think the vision is of Project 2025? You know, you said these people came out, some of them, out of the Trump administration or reacting to the failures of the first Trump administration to effectively remake America. And they were then thinking of Project 2025 as this opportunity, the second opportunity. But is this just about Trump's second term, or is this a kind of longer ranging vision about transforming U.S. society?
I think this is a longer vision, and they see this as a sort of hinge moment. The kind of rhetoric you hear from the authors of Project 2025 really remarkably apocalyptic. They think that the U.S. is on the verge of a Marxist takeover, which is a strange thing. It's not what I see going on, but it's something they believe. and they have this vision that if they don't act now, they're gonna lose their hold on America. And so I think they see this as their chance to turn things around. And they see Trump and they see this administration as an important way to do that. But they're not simply thinking about a four-year timeline. They are looking to change society for the long run and to reorient you know, the way America works and the way that citizens interact with the government and the way the government functions.
Well, Ben, is that built into this plan? I mean, one of the things you note is that, you know, it's not just a blueprint, but something setting up action in the sense that it also furnished names of people to put into positions to occupy the bureaucracy. And although some of those positions, people put in those positions might be enduring, some of it might just be what's possible during a Trump presidency.
Yeah, I think they want to change the kind of baseline. So they know there's only so much they might achieve in Trump's term. They hope that they can change things enough that they can, you know, get another right-wing president elected after that. But I think mostly they want to change the starting point. And they think that they can do that with some of these actions they're taking here. And by sort of reworking, you know, changing so that the government, you know, the basic executive branch functions less with, you know, civil servants who are not chosen based on partisan affiliation and are subject matter experts, and more with people who are political appointees whose paramount importance is loyalty to the president and to his agenda.
Is there much in Project 2025 that indicates how they might see things beyond a Trump term in the sense of whether there would be elections to follow? I mean, it's a pretty authoritarian vision. Reading through it, does one have a sense of literally the vision for after Trump's term is over?
I think there's actually a real lack of foresight there, which is interesting because I think they have thought through a lot of these things fairly carefully. But I think that's one place where they haven't. And they, in some places, will kind of explicitly say, you know, we're not elections guys. We're the policy guys. It's somebody else's job to win elections. And then once they do that, we're going to come in and give the, you know, the policy plans for that. I think the big question is what happens if somebody who they don't like has the kinds of powers that they are trying to, and in many cases succeeding in getting for the president. You can imagine a Democrat winning in 2028, and you can imagine that these people would be very upset about him or her wielding this kind of huge power. You know, they make their case for presidential power in very constitutional terms. You know, they believe that in this kind of unitary executive tradition, that anything in the executive branch, the president should have full control over. Anything other than that is a violation of the Constitution. They object to the idea that Congress would try to intrude on how the president spends money, for example. All these are things that traditionally people on the American right have resisted. And here we have the Project 2025 people accruing a lot of power that could be used, I think, against their aims in the near future.
Right, which I guess maybe begs the question of how democratic a transition they expect after power is concentrated in the hands of a Republican president. But I wonder if you could talk more about that vision for the presidency of this sort of enhanced executive power. Since it didn't come fully fledged out of Project 2025, where did that vision come from and how did they want to see it implemented in the case of Trump's second term?
Yeah, I mean, this is something we've seen over the course of decades, growing presidential power. During the George W. Bush administration, we heard a lot about the idea of the unitary executive, which is that anything or many things under the executive branch should be in the control of the president. But I think this goes a lot farther than that. And it comes from a few things. One is this constitutional vision, this idea that you know, anything that is not assigned to the Congress explicitly should be the president's power. And part of it is a frustration with Congress that, you know, they see Congress over the last 25 years or longer really failing to do its job, failing to pass budgets, failing to function in any meaningful way. And, you know, that's not a particularly, that's not something that only people on the right feel. I think you could get that critique from people on the left, from people in academia, all over the place. What's unusual is their prescription for it, which is to basically bypass the Congress. So they would like to take all of the, you know, kind of alphabet soup regulatory agencies, whether that's Federal Elections Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, take all of these things and put them directly under the power of the president. So the way they're structured now and the way Congress designed them to be structured was the president appoints members of them. They're confirmed by the Senate, and then they act basically independently. And the Project 2025 people want them to be basically outgrowths of White House policy. They say there's no such thing as an independent agency. And so, you know, we've seen in the case of the Federal Communications Commission, a kind of taste of how this might work. The current chair, Brendan Carr, is one of the authors of Project 2025. And even if statutorily it's not a part of the Trump administration, it is functioning very much that way. When you see Brendan Carr going after Trump's critics in the media, whether that's Stephen Colbert or The View or Jimmy Fallon, trying to use it kind of as a bludgeon, using regulation as a bludgeon against political enemies. And we could see that across a range of agencies. We see it in personnel, in Trump's attempts and sometimes success in firing huge swaths of the federal civil service. And we see it also in the question of impoundment. You know, the idea that the president can decline to spend funds that Congress has allocated. They say rather than a congressional allocation being a mandate, it's setting a maximum, but they can spend less. And so they want to have a fight that goes to the Supreme Court about whether the president can just refuse to spend money that Congress wants to spend too. So all of these things come together to create this really powerful president. And though the other thing I would add in is then Trump has tried to do a lot of these things via executive order. With the exception of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, he just doesn't really have a legislative agenda. This is entirely things done through the White House.
And that, of course, is interesting because the Republicans in Congress, by and large, seem to be facilitating that centralization of power in the executive. You know, you were talking about the bypassing of Congress, but they're sort of setting themselves up to be bypassed. Do you think that's because the ideology captured in Project 2025 is broadly shared within the Republican Party?
I think it's a mix. I should admit, I have been a little bit surprised by how much Congress has been willing to do that. I thought that regardless of, you know, whether they had kind of constitutional concerns or moral concerns, Congress would act to kind of preserve its prerogatives. And that isn't what we've seen. We've seen very little attempt to push back on anything the Trump administration has done. I think that's a few things. One of them is definitely that there is ideological agreement with many of them. But I also think that it's a case where there is a real fear. They believe that if they challenge Trump, he will encourage primary challengers. He will try to end their careers. And they have a lot of evidence to show that that is true. So I think they're afraid of him, and that makes a big difference. The one place where we've seen a little bit of pushback is from Republicans in the Senate. Trump has tried to push them to get rid of the filibuster or to change to a talking filibuster. And so far, they have resisted, I think, because they are worried they may be in the minority soon. But it's only on that small procedural thing where they've been willing to challenge Trump.
I'm speaking with journalist David Graham, author of The Project, How Project 2025 is Reshaping America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So let's talk about the process that allowed Trump to implement at least some of the ideas of Project 2025, and that part of the project's orientation was not just the what, but the how to actually make Trump's second term leave with tangible changes to the United States. And so, you know, the centralizing of power in the executive, the gutting of the administrative state all being part of that, the reshaping of the bureaucracy with loyalists. But I wanted to turn now to some of the goals, the policy goals that Project 2025 laid out. Now that we are more than a year into his second term, how successful Trump has also been in trying to achieve those goals. So you were saying that a crucial orientation for Project 2025 has been this Christian right-wing orientation in which the family is meant to be sort of a centerpiece of society. Can you talk about how Project 2025 conceives of the role of the family and how they would like Trump to reorder things so that the family is paramount?
For them, the sort of traditional heterosexual family with a male breadwinner, a mother who is caring for children, and lots of children is the foundation of society. In one chapter, one of the authors writes, "Without women, there are no children, and society cannot continue." I think that is very basic to how they see it. They talk about a biblical vision of the family, and that's something they want to encourage through policy. So they would like to run social services through, not just through faith-based organizations, but through churches specifically. They would like those organizations to instill Christian teachings and to make that, you know, a condition, taking instruction on these things, a condition for things like child support or, you know, rent support, these kind of baseline services. I think that's the most clear place where it comes up. You see this also, obviously, in, for example, opposition to abortion and attempts to cut off access to abortion through any means. It also comes through in interesting other ways. You know, they would like to encourage ways to let women or to force women to stay home and raise children. They think about that in terms of tax incentives. They want to encourage marriage through housing and urban development policies. Really across the board, you see these ways to kind of nudge things toward the vision that they have.
Do you see this as in line with kind of traditional conservatism in that the family is sort of the central, not the, say, the individual as maybe a more neoliberal, economically oriented right-wing vision might hold?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, they talk about the idea of freedom to be not the freedom to do what we want, but the freedom to do what we ought. And I think that's a kind of weirdly collective vision of freedom. They talk about, you know, banning pornography and that sorts of thing. In some ways, you know, what we're hearing, there's obviously been a conservative focus on family, opposition to same-sex marriage, opposition to trans rights. All of these things are not new to the conservative movement, but they're interesting in the way that they look for ways to sort of embed them in government policy and to use this kind of big government approach in ways that, you know, even, for example, the Bush administration, which I think held some of the same views, was unwilling to do.
Tell us about that focus on gender as a battleground, which, as you say, certainly predates Project 2025, but the attack on trans people, that has been such a enormous focus of the right, but certainly the right in power.
Yeah, that's right. It's something that you can sort of feel the obsession with it coming through in the text. They talk a lot about what they call gender ideology, which is the suggestion that there's something other than a binary male-female. You know, they say that that is, reality is there's male and female and nothing else. And they want to push back on any idea otherwise. And they want to do that not only through you know, rhetoric, but literally by changing the language of the government to write trans people out of existence, to push them to the margins. They talk about uprooting gender ideology in all parts of the government. They talk about, you know, using the Education Department and Title IX funding to push back on schools that might offer things like transgender bathrooms. They want to take gender-affirming care out of government services, including the, you know, Veterans Affairs Administration. So they see all of these places where it's really important to them, and they want the way the government works.
Right, and it does seem like the realm of culture and of education are sort of central battlegrounds for them. And I wonder if you could talk about the fixation on diversity, equity, inclusion over ideas of targeting race as a place to push back on, you know, supposed wokeness.
Yeah, wokeness is an animating force throughout Project 2025, which is interesting because they never define it. And I think it's more useful to them when it's left undefined. They're concerned about, they say that wokeness is a problem. They say DEI is a problem. And I think this is part of their belief that society is being, you know, taken away from them. They're worried about anti-Christian discrimination, or what they see as anti-Christian discrimination. And so they talk about changing the way some of these important government bodies that police these things work. So, for example, they want to change the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission from going after, you know, discrimination on the basis of sex or gender identity or transgender status, and they want to change it to be looking for cases of anti-Christian discrimination. Throughout the government, you see these kind of flips with these bodies. And I think what you see also is that although they talk about wokeness and DEI as the target, really their vision is much broader. It is to erase much of the civil rights regime that has existed since the 1960s. So they're dismantling the way the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department works, using it not to pursue, you know, discrimination on the basis of race, but to pursue, you know, bogus claims of voter fraud from 2020. In all these ways, they're trying to roll back the civil rights regime, and they're doing it under the guise of pushing back on wokeness, which they understand has become a more contested term in society.
One of the things that was so striking when Trump came back into office was the full-throated attack on higher education. Did that draw from Project 2025, or was Project 2025 more concerned with K through 12 education?
I'd say it's more the latter. I mean, the focus in Project 2025 is very much on this lower education and what they would like to do, how they want to use the federal government to push what they see as wokeness out of K-12 education, how they want to try to undermine public schools and move towards a system where basically a voucher system for the whole, you know, for the whole nation, where the federal government gives block grants to states and states can do whatever they want with it as long as it's legal under state law, so they can, you know, establish religious schools, establish any number of things. They are also interested in things like vocational education. There's an animosity towards higher education in Project 2025 that I think matches with what the Trump administration does. There's a brief discussion of the problems, what they see the problems of high overhead in federal government grants to universities. So I think there's a clear ideological agreement there, but the kind of full-scale attack that we've seen from Trump isn't really something that they outline in detail.
So then around these dimensions of Project 2025 that are around gender and the family and race and education and this general idea of rights, you know, you wrote about Project 2025 before this first year of Trump's presidency had taken place. And I just wonder, in considering all of those goals, how would you judge the degree of success in those aspects of society being remade?
I think they've been very successful in many cases, but not entirely. If you see the kind of work they have done on education or the attacks on universities or in undermining basic rights, whether through executive orders, through changing the way these government agencies work, they have gone a long way on many of those things. Some of them are tied up in court, and they will remain that way. But I think they've been very effective in sort of taking on these social issues. But I think there are a couple places where they have not done much, and I think those are interesting. One of them is the area of kind of labor. They're trying, I think, in ways that are genuine, if maybe not necessarily effective, to create a somewhat more worker-friendly environment. You know, they want to have time and a half for workers or else a Sabbath, and they want to create workplace childcare, these things that I think potentially areas for bipartisan agreement. They haven't done anything along those lines. And then I think the really important one is abortion access. The Trump administration has certainly not been a friend of abortion access, but we have not seen it be a major focus for the. I think partly because Robert F. Kennedy Jr. doesn't seem to have strong views about it and has been much more focused on vaccines, and this is something that would come out of the Department of Health and Human Services. But we, you know, the Project 2025 authors want to see, ideally, a national ban on abortion. Barring that, they would like to see the FDA withdraw approval for the drugs used for medical abortion. They would like to use the Postal Service to ban the sending of abortion drugs under a 19th century statute. They would like to track abortions at the state level to create this huge surveillance regime. None of that has happened, and I think that is a little bit galling for many people in the anti-abortion movement, because that is one of their most fundamental issues, one of the things they care most about, and that hasn't been something Trump has done a lot on in his first year and plus.
I'm speaking with journalist David Graham. He's the author of The Project, How Project 2025 is Reshaping America. We're discussing the blueprint for Trump's second term, drawn up by the Heritage Foundation a year into his presidency, what has succeeded and what hasn't. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So one place that the goals of Project 2025 have been met with flying colors is around the environment. Can you tell us about what the project advocated and what we have seen?
Yeah, they would like to see a kind of full-scale attack on environmental regulation, on green energy, on green research, really across the board. So there's a few major things. One is an attack on science. They would like to undermine many of the government bodies that provide our basic understanding of the world around us. That includes, NOAA, which forecasts the weather. They would like to privatize that. They would like to hive some of those things off into the private sector or reduce them. And a lot of this is a kind of terror that these bodies are producing data that shows that climate change is real. And, you know, they see that as part of ideological war, and they simply want to stop that. They also want to reduce environmental regulation, and that's across the board. We have seen the EPA just recently, for example, withdrawing its finding that carbon dioxide is dangerous. That is something that they advocate. They would like to pull back on much of the regulation of greenhouse gases, but they wouldn't stop there. They also are looking to withdraw, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, basic enforcement along these lines. Things like forever chemicals, they say they're just too hard to regulate, and so we can't regulate them. And they tell this kind of triumphal story that, back in the 1960s and 70s, the air was choked with smog and the rivers were catching on fire. But we implemented some common sense regulation, and we've moved on from that. And now we don't need to have those kinds of regulations. We can move on from all of that. And the third big area is doing everything that they can to encourage fossil fuel exploitation. So that's, granting offshore drilling permits. It is opening up new space in places like the Arctic National Refuge. And it's really making the Interior Department into fundamentally an agency that is designed to encourage oil and gas exploitation. An important part of that, then, is withdrawing any support for clean energy technologies. So cracking down on government aid for solar, for wind, for any alternative power sources, withdrawing subsidies for electric cars and electric car infrastructure. So across the board, as you say, they have made a great deal of progress on in these first 15 months or so.
Which is interesting as well, because certainly there are a number of red states that benefit from wind power. And there was some thought that maybe because of that, there wouldn't be an attempt to roll that back, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
I think there are a lot of places where what Project 2025 is proposing would punish red states and Republican voters. This is a great example. I think closure, reducing many of the sort of federal medical aid programs or help for rural hospitals, for example. These are things that are going to punish largely Trump supporters. And for the authors of Project 2025, I think they are, they are true ideological warriors, and they understand that, but they believe this is what needs to be done. They also understand things may not be popular, but they don't care because they think they're important.
One place that there's quite a bit of division within the right is around trade. And that even was reflected in Project 2025, and we've certainly seen that in Trump's second presidency with tariffs being thrown around left, right, and center to the consternation of those who might be some of his well-heeled backers who draw a lot of their wealth from free trade and laissez-faire policies. Can you tell us about how trade was laid out, the goals around trade within this document, Project 2025?
I think it is it's one of these interesting cases of the kind of divisions that you mentioned earlier within the movement. You have in the Heritage Foundation, a group of people who have been part of the Republican Party for a long time, in its guise as a sort of free trade globalist party. And they are jostling with the more Trump MAGA tariff crowd. And they're basically trying to figure out how to reconcile those or what they can go along with. And it seems like in many cases they have decided they're willing to go along with tariffs in order to get the other things they want. Because they understand that for Trump, there are the very few things that he cares very deeply about, one of the few policy areas he really cares about. In Project 2025, you have two competing chapters, one by the head of a free trade think tank, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And then you have a different chapter arguing for tariffs from Peter Navarro, one of Trump's top aides. And it's really interesting to read these back to back. One says, free trade made Americans wealthier. The tariffs that Trump implemented in his first term and that Joe Biden continued have made people poorer. We should stop. And in the following chapter, you have Navarro making a case for very high tariffs, particularly on China. I think Trump has gone in a somewhat different direction using tariffs, not just against China, but really as a weapon of political warfare against Europe, against Brazil, against Canada, against anyone who's not willing to agree with him on everything else. And I think there is some reluctance among members of the coalition about that. But they also understand that Trump is driving the train and he's a big fan.
Another place that is interesting in Project 2025 is around big tech and some notions of reining in big tech a bit when, of course, much of big tech has been incredibly supportive of the Trump administration.
Yeah, I think it's an effective buying off, basically. There is this group that believes that technology is a real danger, both because of closeness with China, for example, or closeness with what they see as liberal intellectuals, but also because they think that social media is bad for the family, it's bad for children, it attacks this kind of Christian worldview. And those people have really found themselves kind of blocked out. Silicon Valley moved very quickly to cozy up to Trump at the beginning of this term, and even before, in the presidential campaign. And what we've seen is they've been able to get access and stop any real regulation of the tech industry and kind of co-opt the president.
Now, obviously, many of these people can come together for tax breaks for the wealthy, a long cherished aspiration of conservatives. But how do the writers of Project 2025 view the question of the national debt, which is something that has divided those on the right?
It's a really interesting discussion, how they treat the economy. They want to see lower taxes across the board. They advocate for basically a flat tax, which would be much more regressive than the current income tax. And there are things that they want to cut. But here again, they're jostling up against what Trump wants. And Trump has been vocally supportive of things like Social Security and Medicare, if not always in policy terms. So they can't argue for huge cuts to those things because they know that Trump would object. So they really just don't explain how they would reduce the deficit or balance the budget. They simply want to reduce taxes, sort of encourage a kind of trickle-down mindset, and go from there, I guess.
So when Trump was elected, analysts point to both his message around bringing down inflation, an economic message, but also a message around immigration. And yet, of course, how that's played out in the past year plus has turned out quite interesting in that the base of support for his policies around immigration has sort of fallen out with many people who have been horrified to see what it looks like in practice. The kind of incredibly violent immigration policy that Trump has enacted in the last year or so, including ICE terrorizing cities and terrorizing people. How much of that comes from Project 2025?
I think it's very much drawn from Project 2025. We've seen Trump obviously talk about border security for a long time, at militarizing the southern border, closing the border, deploying the military there. And we saw attempts to do that during the first Trump administration, and we've seen rhetoric about that. But I think what Project 2025 shows and where it's manifesting in this administration is a couple things. One is these assaults on cities really inside the country. They're not just trying to stop people from coming into the country. They are trying to round up as many people as they can who are already in the country and take them out with these major intrusive military operations. And the second question is not just attacking illegal immigration, but attacking legal immigration. So when you see the Trump administration trying to withdraw visas from students and attack, trying to withdraw the status of people like Mahmoud Khalil, that is an idea straight out of Project 2025, too. It's not just that they want to get rid of, undocumented immigrants. They want all immigrants out, and they want to sort of create a Fortress America with the same demographics, its historical demographics, rather than bringing in anybody who might, to their eyes, muddy that up.
What about having the military in the streets, in some form, armed men and women in the streets?
That's also an idea that Project 2025 contemplates. The authors write that the military isn't something that has been used widely for this. There's a good reason for that, which is that it is, extremely limited by the Posse Comitatus Act. And we've seen when the Trump administration has tried to do this, Federal judges have pushed back on them and said that they are not acting within their rights. But I think we're going to continue to see the government trying to do this. We also see Trump, you know, trying to work around that, for example, by claiming the National Guard is out to control crime when it appears it's more part of immigration operations. But this kind of militarization, large-scale operations, is something that Project 2025 recommends.
David Graham, let me ask you about Project 2025's vision for U.S. foreign policy and for the military. Obviously, given the U.S. attack on Iran, it begs the question of whether this was part of Project 2025's vision, much of which seems to be about China. But where does Iran and the broader Middle East fit into this vision?
I think this is a place where the Project 2025 people have been largely rolled. Their vision is they're focused on China. And other than that, they're fairly isolationist. I mean, it's much closer to what we saw in the first Trump administration than I think what we've seen this time. They speak very briefly about Iran, and they say, you know, a nuclear Iran would be a bad thing. They kind of nod at support for Israel, but there's not really an interest in having a lot of American policy in the rest of the world. And Trump seems to have broken with them on that. I think it's interesting to see how that plays out in the administration, where Marco Rubio, who has a foot in the more hawkish Republican Party, sort of Bush Party, has been driving the train, it looks like, on Iran. And J.D. Vance, who I think is probably more closely aligned with Project 2025 on policy than any other politician in America, has been very quiet. He seems marginalized, and he doesn't seem very involved in it. And I think that's really symbolic of how Project 2025 is losing the foreign policy battle.
And yet, perhaps this is ubiquitous across the board of all the factions you're talking about, but Project 2025 advocated for increasing military spending. And Trump, who, you know, talked about all the vast waste of the military-industrial complex before he was elected, then has vastly increased the military budget.
Right, exactly. They definitely want to spend that money. And as we see, you know, repeatedly, presidents seem, they become enchanted by the idea of using war machines, and they can't resist it.
One thing I wanted to ask you about that I think surprised a lot of people at the beginning of Trump's second term, the ferocity of these changes that were set into motion by Trump, his vast series of executive orders, these incredibly far-reaching policies that upended kind of mainstream conventional wisdom in many cases. One of the things that I think surprised people was that they associated Trump, and do associate Trump, with surrounding himself with not particularly bright people, often people who may have donated millions of dollars to his campaigns, but not necessarily people who know how to get things done, who have a kind of far-reaching vision. And we see of the high-profile members of his government, people who do not exude competence. And yet, at the same time, what was put into action was enormously effective. Would you conclude that part of this may be the more concrete, hands-on aspect of Project 2025 involving putting lower-level functionaries into place to push through agendas?
Yeah, I think that is an important part of this. You know, the Project 2025 organizers understood that Trump or any other president was going to put, you know, is going to put in place the people they want at level. And their understanding of the government formed by their time in the first Trump administration or other time was it's important to have these people whose names you don't know. A cabinet secretary is in many cases kind of just a front man or front woman. And what's important to have the deputies and the assistants and the people who are working on these programs who can actually get things done. And I think if you look at a place like the Pentagon, you can see this particularly clearly. Pete Hegseth is not someone who seems to have a great deal of interest in policy minutiae. He's there because he looks good on TV to Trump. And so what's more important is having other people at the Pentagon who are going to try to institute your goals. You can see this the same thing in many departments. I mean, you can see that at the Justice Department, for example, where Pam Bondi seems to be largely a sort of a prominent spokesperson. But there are other people who are driving the train below her, like Todd Blanche, Trump's former personal attorney. So it's about getting those people in at the low level. And I also think it was about having a plan on day one. They were concerned that in the first Trump administration, Trump had had a really slow learning curve to get things done. And so they were writing executive orders. They put together a 100-day plan so that when he reached office, they would be able to start issuing these things right away. And they knew that speed was of the essence. They knew they needed to take the media, the population, and Republicans in Congress a little bit by surprise and keep them off balance. And so they wanted to have this kind of shock and awe in the first administration. And I think it worked.
Are there things that you think we can expect from this administration that were explored or advocated in Project 2025, which have not yet been implemented or fulfilled?
I'm really interested to see the abortion question. I think that's a really important one. I think the other thing that is, I think, most important is what happens once Trump has the formerly independent regulatory agencies under his control. We have the Supreme Court considering this case. All indications are they're likely to overturn the 1935 precedent that creates independent agencies, which will mean Trump can hire and fire the heads of these bodies at will, which means he's basically in control of them. And I think that's really going to reshape the way Americans interact with the government. You know, it has to do with what you see on your TV and how your elections work and how things work in your workplace and what discrimination looks like and how your children in schools, all of these things that are really not just kind of abstract policy battles, but things that affect everyone in their everyday life. I don't think I have a great sense of what that's going to look like. And I think many people don't realize that's coming. And so these kinds of implementations of the things they have already achieved are going to come over the next year or two. And I think they're going to be, you know, really important for what the government looks like and the way American society works.
Does that include the independence of the Federal Reserve? And if so, do you think that that may lead to some divisions within those who support him? Because potentially, although the Fed is a longtime target of conspiracy theories, at the same time, for those who support Trump, who are corporations that don't want to see the global economy go down the toilet, it can create all sorts of uncertainty that isn't seen as, you know, good for business.
Yeah, that's right. And we've already seen a little bit of that. I mean, you know, the authors of Project 2025 would have the Fed abolished entirely and return us to something like the gold standard. And I think that's already a step too far. Trump would like to just have control of the Fed. And we've seen the Supreme Court not willing to sign on to that in the way they're willing to countenance, you know, his takeover of a lot of these agencies. You know, I think part of Project 2025's view is an expectation that the Supreme Court will basically go along with the things they ask for. And so far that's been right, but the Federal Reserve is one notable area where the justices don't seem willing to let Trump have his way.
Are there things, beyond the things you've touched on, that Trump has put into motion that kind of run against the general orientation of Project 2025? Anything that surprised you?
I don't think so. I mean, I've been very surprised by his foreign policy moves because they are so far away from it. But the thing about Trump is he doesn't have that many policy interests. You know, he cares a lot about political retribution. He cares a lot about immigration. He cares a lot about tariffs. And what the authors of Project 2025 recognized, I think, was that they could fill in all the other gaps. They could kind of set an agenda for all those things that he doesn't care about. And, you know, they're not batting 1,000, but they have had remarkable success on many of them.
Let me end by asking you about Project 2025 and this question of managing politics and fallout. You know, you wrote that they didn't spend a lot of time thinking about if someone is elected after Trump and they're not a Republican, what that might be like with all this concentrated executive power. But more generally, how sophisticatedly do you think they read how people might respond, the U.S. public at large, how the public may respond to all sorts of policies that might seem actually quite unappealing or not at all what they thought they were voting for? In terms of the longevity of this project, is there any exploration in Project 2025 of how to manage the public?
They don't talk about it explicitly. And I think they understand that it's a lot of these things are not popular. Heritage did some polling in the summer of 2024, and they found in swing states, voters were heavily aware of Project 2025, and they really hated it. I also saw polling from Democratic firms that showed that although people didn't like the things in Project 2025, they just didn't believe that Trump would actually do them if he took office. Now we see those things, and we see, you know, a lot of voters are upset about many of the things that Trump is doing and about the things he's not doing, like having any kind of focus on affordability, for example. You know, I think they understood that these things were unpopular and they wanted to do them anyway because they believe they're important. But I don't think they have a strong political plan for how to manage that fallout and how to make these things permanent, which is a problem when you're not enacting them through legislation and when they're deeply unpopular.
I said that was the last thing, but I'm going to squeeze this in.
All good.
Well, related to these questions of sort of reading the public and managing the public, I wanted to ask you about how they see the left in Project 2025, because it seems like, you know, they're writing about another planet in their assumptions about, you know, a Marxist takeover, which really seems like their target is actually mainstream liberalism, but they're calling it Marxist. And this notion that the left is this kind of incredibly united, regimented force, which I actually think often the left thinks of the right erroneously. They also seem to think about the left. Do you think that they're sort of just kind of clueless in their understanding, if I can call it that, of liberalism and then actually the left?
I think that many of the people involved in Project 2025, although they are very well versed in policy, are also existing inside the conservative media bubble, where everything from the center, you know, mainstream center left to the hard left is all one thing. It's all Marxist. It's all woke. You know, all of these terms are used sloppily and just as insults. And I think they have really bought into this idea that there was a really regimented, organized left, that it is unified, and that it is very successful, and that it's a real threat to them. And I see a very apocalyptic sense from the way they talk about it. But it doesn't look to me like what I see when I look out my window.
David Graham, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of The Project, How Project 2025 is Reshaping America. David Graham is staff writer at The Atlantic. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.